This is Jillian Parks, Associate Producer for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer. I'm here at beautiful Garvin Gardens in Hot Springs, Arkansas, speaking with Rush, the Education Director. Here we are at Garvin Gardens.
Welcome to the gardens. I'm Rush, the Education Director here.
Thank you. How long have you been working here at this beautiful gardens?
I have been working here for 10 years.
What's your favorite part?
My favorite part depends on the time of year. A lot of times it's the children's garden, but right around now I would say the Japanese garden. The Garden of the Pine Wind is a series of cascades, boulder work, and ornamentals, azaleas that really shine this time of year and really highlight the care given to this garden.
Is this a family-friendly place, would you say?
Absolutely. We just drove through the children's garden, which features a three-story treehouse, boulders, and all sorts of fun things for children to engage with.
Is it dog-friendly?
It's dog-friendly most of the time. Now, during the winter season, we have the holiday lights display, which occurs at night. And during that time, pets are not allowed. But the rest of the year, we'd love to have your furry friends as long as they have their rabies vaccination.
Hey, have you had any unique visitors to the garden that you can recall?
Should I tell her about the burlesque dancer?
Yeah, it's a good one. Yep.
Well, we have tons of photography out here because of all the displays. And so one time a local burlesque dancer came fully robed, of course, to the ticket booth. But by the time she made it out to the gardens for photos, let's just say it wasn't as family friendly as it should be.
Fantastic. And you have weddings out here as well?
Yes, around 200 weddings per year. The Anthony Chapel is one of the prime locations, but also garden weddings. And so plenty of unique venues and opportunities for groups of all sizes, great for destination weddings, and just good weather year-round. So we do quite a few. They're a huge boost to the rest of the garden's programs. And so a big revenue generating stream for us, and we're very thankful for that.
Fantastic. And what is the size of this?
We're sitting on about 210 acres. It's a double peninsula that juts out into Lake Hamilton. We've got about 4.5 miles of shoreline on Lake Hamilton. About half of that is very extensively manicured. Some of that is storage and operations, but 210 acres from what used to be 400. Before the lake was built, about 400 acres, and then Carpenter Dam was built, impounding and creating Lake Hamilton, and that would shrunk that to the remaining ridge that you see on our map.
And how many employees do you have here?
We have about 60 employees in all veins of our operation: accounting, purchasing, horticulture, grounds, education. 60 total, about half of which are full-time, half of which are part-time, and then the occasional student intern. The university that operates this garden is in Fayetteville. They're a few hours away, and so typically that's reserved for summertime, but we typically have a few interns to come support us.
Oh, that's wonderful. I heard you have peacocks.
We have peacocks. George and Sabrina are longtime favorites here. George is very friendly and outgoing. He loves to show his tail for all the photographers and for Sabrina, of course. They're the stars of the show. They don't even know that the gardens are here because they think they're the focal point.
And I heard that the tulips, after they bloom, you sell them. That's amazing.
We do. The tulips don't perennialize very well here. The winters are not quite cold enough. And so here, for the tulips to come back up, you don't get a predictable as of a bloom as you would. And so, yes, we pull up all 150,000 tulip bulbs. We put them in crates and we offer them to the visitors in exchange for a $10 donation.
Wow.
And then we order 150,000 more tulips imported from the Netherlands.
Yeah. That's amazing. So we'd like to learn more about these beautiful gardens. Where would you send us?
Best place to learn about the gardens is probably social media. We have a pretty good presence there on Facebook, Instagram, probably TikTok. Visit Hot Springs is our city's designated marketing organization, so they put out videos. They have a lot of good content to help you learn about the gardens and see what it's like. Prior to Thanksgiving through New Year's Eve, we have the holiday lights display.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. This has been Jillian Parks at Garvin Gardens in beautiful Hot Springs, Arkansas. We'll see you here. This is Jillian Parks, Associate Producer for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer. While in beautiful Hot Springs, Arkansas, at a pub, we were lucky enough to run into James Zegras, the owner of Avant Mining. So we pulled him outside and we asked him some questions.
James Zegras.
So you own the
Avant Mining, yeah.
Okay.
Avant Mining Crystal Company.
And how did you, so you're from New Jersey, but you yes. came down here because?
The Crystals called me. So it was Unique Opportunities about 17 years ago for the first time, mm-hmm. and bought one property to mine one specific mineral, which then evolved into dozens of properties and thousands of acres, turned into a large company. So
that's amazing. And so what do you do with all of the rocks, the minerals?
So we mine mostly quartz crystals, but we also have turquoise and wavelite, which is a very popular mineral, and a variety of other minerals as well, like titanium minerals like brookite and things like that. We work with artists and museums and various people, so and entities. It's turned into a large business.
Do you use them for, is there any industrial purpose for any of these?
There are, but I don't sell industrially at the moment. But the, yes, silicon is a strategic mineral. So we have high purity quartz, which is a government classified strategic mineral.
So how did you know that Arkansas was sort of the motherland for this kind of a cache?
It's always been well known. It's been known since like, well, we don't really know who the first people were. There were people using crystals for at least 12,000, 15,000 years. The Clovis people were here making crystal arrowheads. Poverty Point culture, which is, again, about maybe 7,000 to 10,000, and then various other cultures. And then Hernando de Soto was the first Westerner. So they're very well documented through Hernando de Soto in 1542 up until the French being here. And then in the mid-1800s, when this sort of became almost like a touristy place, in the 1850s and 60s, it became an industry, and it's been famous ever since. So farmers would bring wagon loads of crystals to town and sell them off of their carts, mule-drawn carts with crystals on the back.
And what would they use them for? Like, I love the crystals. Like, well, rose quartz is for peace, and this one is for fertility. I mean, not for me personally, but for my other people. But what did they use those crystals for?
Just for display then. You know, it was like the scientific enlightenment. Crystallography and things were discovered in the 19th century, so people became fascinated with things like quartz. Quartz is how we discovered crystal form. And then crystal form led to all sorts of science and very important discoveries. They didn't have spiritual uses in the 19th century as much. Crystal balls did, and so if they cut crystal balls, those did have spiritual uses, but not like they are today. Today, they're very much used in healing and
really,
and
some people still like, let me consult my crystal ball.
Oh, yeah. There's thousands of people, probably tens of thousands of people a year that come here for that. For crystals, for the energy, for the power, for the healing and stuff.
Are you a geologist?
No, I'm self-taught. I'm just a mineral collector. Probably the current largest installation where you could see crystals from the Zegris mine, which my company Avant Mining owns, is at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, which David Yerman, the jeweler, sponsored and paid for. And so that's a 80-foot long wall of giant crystals from the Zegris mine. But there are crystals from my mine in most museums in the world. So you can see the stuff around the world in most museums.
Okay, for someone who has such a significant historical and geological imprint on our culture, you're pretty chill.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, I've got a few things, but try to be low key.
This is Jillian Parks, Associate Producer for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer. We are here at Origami Sake in Hot Springs, Arkansas, speaking with Matt Bell, the President and CEO of Origami Sake.
We're really going for a premium craft style that is more fruit forward, higher acidity, clean finish, so your mouth should water when you're done drinking a sip of this, versus being really trying to introduce people to your first impression of sake can often be a bad one. So changing that, you know, impression of sake,
right,
is key to what we're doing. So we make a drier style. We do that in limited releases. We're probably going to introduce a style that's more dry, but there's a lot of those products in the market. So we're trying to be a little bit different and trying to introduce sake to places that are unusual for sake to be, you know, so a steakhouse, pizza place. You don't get French wine just in a French restaurant. So it's what can you do with sake? And sake is really more versatile with food than wine. wine you have to pair specifically with food. Cab with steak, dessert wines, sake just goes with everything. It's very versatile with food. You know, it goes great with spicy food, it goes great with pizza, it goes great with a wide range. And one of the things that breaks down when you have food pairings is, think about Brussels sprouts, stewed vegetables, they just fall apart with wine. So sake does very well with vegetables. This one is obviously non-alcoholic zero. This one's 14.5%. This one's about 15%, and this one's 12.5%. It can go up to 20%. The range is typically 10 to 16. My co-founder I met in 2016, his name was Ben Bell. He's no longer here. He's stepped away for health reasons, but he went and spent a year in Japan. So actually the reason he went to Japan was because of Hot Springs Sister City program with Hanamaki Japan. He went to Japan and tutored under a world-renowned sake brewery in Iwate Prefecture, which is where Hanamaki is. It's called Nambu Bijin Brewery, 150-year-old brewery, and he wanted to learn the process of making sake, so he spent a year there. I met him in 2016, and we didn't start this till 2021. The idea, he wanted to start this brewery, but it's a lot of challenges in starting a brewery. There's not many breweries in the United States. There's a lack of knowledge in the United States, lack of skill set. Very specific skills to make sake, and all of it's in Japanese. So converting that, and really, you know, these sake breweries, some of these on the wall in there are 400 years old. Actually, you can't get a new sake brewery permit in the whole country of Japan. You haven't been able to get one for 10 years. So they've ceased allowing new breweries to open. One of the reasons why being domestic is an advantage, because you want to have fresh sake. There are aged sakes, so there's a lot of aged sakes out there. You can buy aged sakes. It's just really small part of the category. One of the things that's really great about sake is that if you're familiar with wine, you open a wine, you've got about 2 days to drink that wine. It goes through a Bayard reaction, turn into vinegar. Sake doesn't do that. So sake will keep for a couple weeks after you open it. So it's really good for by-the-glass service in restaurants that don't want to commit to, you know, if you can have a bottle of sake, keep it open, or open it, you're good for 2 weeks without having to pour it down the drain. Good in cocktails too. Think about a beer and wine license where you can't make a cocktail. If you just have a beer and wine license, it's hard to make any good beverages out of wine and beer. But with sake, it's very clean, very neutral. You can make a sakerita. You can make a lot of different things with just very simple ingredients. Lime juice, simple syrup, tastes like margarita. We've had a lot of international awards for our sake. This is the only sake to win at Tokyo Gold Medal. First place to grow sake rice outside of Japan. So in 1997, the farm here started growing sake varieties of rice. And combine that with water. And Hot Springs has the best water aquifer for brewing sake in the United States. So great soft water aquifer, the Washita Mountain aquifer. It has no iron, no manganese, and very great characteristics in pH and balance for brewing sake. So that's 99% of sake plus craftsmanship and having the skill to make it. So that's why we're here in Arkansas. We source everything 100% from Arkansas. We're solar powered 100%. All of electric is solar powered. We do have to buy gas to steam, but other than that, we're trying to be as sustainable as possible as well. There's 147 sake varieties of rice, multitudes of polishing rates, multitudes of yeast. There's infinite styles of sake you can make, different brewing methods. So kind of the through line is the art of making sake and the art of origami in Japanese culture. A lot of rice goes into a batch. So we'll produce sake, and once it's done fermenting, the final step prior to canning or bottling is a press. Squeezes out all the sake. It's in that room back there with the glass window. We press the sake out in that big blue machine in that behind that door. So this is actually a Italian wine bottling machine. So bottling in Japan, they have different enclosure types. So in order to get wine bottles, so in our enclosure, it's a twist top. You don't use cork in sake, so just wine bottling. The press is very hard to get, so they're very specialized. Fermentation tanks aren't so hard, but a lot of the special equipment in sake is hard to get here in the U.S. So So you have to retrofit other things to make it work. My name is Matt Bell. To get more information on Origami Sake, go to drinkorigami.com.
We're in Hot Springs, Arkansas at Origami Sake. We'll see you here. I'm your host, Jillian Parks, reporting from Hot Springs, Arkansas.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.